cut Tom, or, you know, we can't air Democracy Now, or we got to shut Mark Cofield down. No, we got to keep this going. We got to keep this going. It's not that far away from the elections, and so we're just putting the word out there. It's up to you. 818-985-5735. Mark, it's been cool. We are out of here. You, any last words you want to say to the folks?
Have a great Sunday.
Yeah. All right, we're out of here. And this is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
As inspiration.
If you've tuned into KPFK at all during these last few weeks, you've likely heard your favorite hosts asking you to make a financial contribution in support of this listener-sponsored community radio station. If you have made your contribution, we want to say thank you so much. If you're able to pledge, but still have not yet, we really urge you to do so now. The amount of that contribution is, of course, up to you. A single $25 pledge will make you a member, and an ongoing monthly pledge will make you a sustaining member, which is very helpful for KPFK. Only you know what's right for you. As you decide, please consider how consistently KPFK focuses on the issues that matter, and how much the world needs to continue hearing the important voices that regularly broadcast over the KPFK airwaves. Then please give as generously as you're able. You can make your pledge on our website at kpfk.org/donate, or you can call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you for listening, and thank you for contributing.
Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Alan Minsky, sitting in for Susie Weissman. On today's show, we're going to have two conversations relating to the upcoming election. In the first segment, we'll be talking to economist Mark Paul about what economists really think about rent control in relationship to Prop 33 on the California ballot. And in the second half of the show, we'll be talking to the nation's John Nichols about the general election in the United States of America. All that and more, stay tuned to Beneath the Surface. Hello, everybody. Alan Minsky here, of course. And I'm here with Mark Paul, who is a professor of public policy at Rutgers. And Mark Paul is also, between you and me audience, really just one of the most inspiring young economists that I know in the country and the world, and a real ally of everybody in our society who's looking at the way America is operating as a macroeconomy and recognizing that it really isn't working out for working people and the average citizen. So welcome, Mark Paul.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And Mark wrote a fantastic article in The American Prospect back in 2023, which actually makes the case that, yes, it has been orthodoxy among economists to say that rent control is a bad idea. Only now there's evidence and there's been studies done which show that that is not the case. So in this context, where the no on Prop 33 are flooding the citizens of California with these ads that are saying economists say rent control is a bad idea. First, explain to us, why is it that there's this idea that it's the orthodox opinion of economists to oppose rent control? And then why is it so wrong?
So, you know, this is such an important and honestly a bit of a complicated question. So let me just back up to start. So for most economists, we live in more or less the best of all possible worlds. And in their mind, in their mental model that they're working with, you know, any quote unquote government intervention and the market leads to kind of worse outcomes than would be otherwise the case. Now, one thing that's kind of complicating of that story is we don't have well-functioning markets without government, but that's kind of left to the sidelines. So in general, the vast majority of economists, it is true, card-carrying economists do not support the use of rent control and do not believe that rent control is effective policy. However, I think that there's quite robust evidence to show that they're wrong, that they have the story wrong. You know, economists say pretty wild things sometimes about rent control. Greg Mankiw, who was George Bush's, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under George Bush, goes so far as to say in his best-selling textbook that rent control is the best way to destroy a city other than bombing it, which is some pretty perverse language, if you ask me, not to mention just factually incredibly wrong. So why do economists actually think this, and what are they missing? Now, to illustrate this, I think it's helpful to look at a very similar policy, which is something that, you know, everybody's going to be familiar with, the minimum wage. 20 years ago, economists all said minimum wages were a terrible idea. They'll actually make low-income people worse off. And in fact, minimum wages and rent controls are, in some sense, similar policies. They're forms of what we call price controls. It's the government saying, hey, we need to regulate the market to ensure we don't pay people poverty wages. In the case of minimum wages, or in the case of rent controls, the government saying, hey, you know, we need to limit the amount by which a landlord can increase rent every year. So both of these are forms of price controls. And what's fascinating is in the Econ 101 model, you know, yes, minimum wages are bad. They lead to unemployment. They lead to what we would call welfare loss. And you know, normal speak is just people being worse off. But all of the empirical evidence, decades now of just the best quality studies one could hope for, all show that that just isn't true. That in fact, that paying workers more money means workers have more money to spend to take care of their kids and pay their rent and shop at local businesses. And in fact, there's no unemployment that results from it, nothing measurable. So we can actually ask something similar of rent control. The classic story is that, you know, economist says, hey, there is available housing at every segment of the market. You only have $800 a month to pay for rent. There's available housing for you. You have $1,200, there's available housing for you. You have $3,000, there's available housing for you. There's available housing of different quality at all segments of the market. Now, of course, if you actually talk to somebody who's ever looked for housing, especially in California, we know that that's just crazy speak. Nevertheless, that's the world that they're operating off of. And they say, hey, if you go in and you put in this price control, this regulation that limits how much landlords can change price from, you know, year to year on tenants, that will actually lead to a reduction in the housing supply. In other words, you know, landlords will pull properties off the rental market or build fewer rental properties, things like that. And in fact, this idea that's supposed to help low and moderate income people afford to rent is actually going to hurt us. Now, here too, we have years upon years upon years of evidence that actually show us, you know, what the data say. And what do the data say? The data say that rent control increases affordability for renters. In other words, one of the most important goals of the policy, that it increases rental affordability. You know, check. The other really important benefit that it says, which is something that we don't talk about very often, is that it increases neighborhood stability. It keeps people in their homes, in their communities, within their social networks for longer. And it keeps kids in, you know, the same school districts for longer. These all have huge benefits. And so, you know, it brings additional stability. Check there again. So in fact, rent control is kind of this boogeyman that economists love to beat on. But when we take a step back and say, let's kind of shed our ideological priors and look at the evidence, we actually see that rent control is a pretty common sense policy that does quite a bit of good. Now, one thing I do want to highlight here, though, back in World War I, actually, the U.S. has had multiple different forms of rent control, both during World War I and War II. But in World War I, the United States actually implemented a form of rent control that I would say was poorly designed. Mm-hmm. And it's true that it had some adverse outcomes. What they did there is they just froze all rents. Mm-hmm. Modern day rent control simply regulates the rate at which a landlord can increase the price from year to year. So rather than allowing a landlord to jack up rents by 15%, as so many did during the pandemic, they might say the landlord can only increase the rent by 2 or 5 or 6% a year. And we can get into different features later in our conversation. And, you know, why do they do it that way today? Because they've learned from historic mistakes made by policymakers and realize, okay, when it comes to rent control, as with basically any other public policy one could imagine, we can design it in good ways that have certain outcomes, or we can design it in poor ways that make the policy either ineffective or have perverse outcomes. And so it's important to note that we need to design it well. And if designed well, and if properly thought through, rent control has been shown to have pretty significant benefits.
Now, in the No on Prop 33 ads with Ken Rosen, who is the economist from Stanford, who's become basically the face of the No on Prop 33 blitz advertisement that's just all over California, he, of course, makes the case that rent control will depress the building of new affordable housing. Of course, the major flaw that I think is most people watching that should be able to ask themselves is, but there's no, this law is not in place yet, and there's no affordable housing in California. That seems itself to really betray their argument there. So speak to that, and particularly how we can, how yes on Prop 33, in fact, can be in harmony with policies to actually generate more affordable housing in California, which is a necessity too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anybody who's trying to make a living in California knows that affordable housing, or even something that resembles something even seemingly affordable, just does not exist in the state, unfortunately. It is a tremendous problem. Look, I want to be clear. I don't want to oversell rent control. Rent control is not a panacea. It is not a one-size-fits-all policy that's going to solve our housing woes. We have a housing, you know, system across the state that simply is not working for the vast majority of people. And rent control is, in my understanding of it, is one important piece of the puzzle to improve the housing crisis, to, you know, really get the housing crisis under control. But we can't and shouldn't, you know, think that it is a silver bullet. So, you know, to address your question, you know, Ken Rosen is saying that rent control is going to reduce the creation of new affordable housing. So let's just break that down for a moment. First of all, let's ask the point of rent control. The point of rent control is to increase affordability and to increase neighborhood stability. The point of rent control is not to increase new housing. In fact, rent control is not suited to do that. So we shouldn't say or ask rent control to create new housing. That's not what the policy is intended to do. But it is reasonable to ask, will rent control harm the creation of new housing? Will it have this unintended consequence? And in fact, there's absolutely no evidence in the myriad of studies that have been conducted both in California and New Jersey and Massachusetts over the years, as well as New York, that look at both the implementation of rent control as well as the repeal of rent control. And in both those instances, they do not find a discernible change in the creation of new housing. In other words, implementing rent control does not lead to you know, this tremendous drop in new construction of affordable housing, but also repealing rent control, as occurred in Massachusetts, did not lead to a boom in construction of new affordable housing either, as would be the case if, you know, Rosen's comments carried any water. So yes, it's true that the basic Econ 101 model that has led us astray in so many facets of our lives tells us that, but it's not really grounded in any meaningful evidence and reality. So, you know, what I say to people here is that we need to think about what are our other complementary policies to rent control that can help us achieve more affordable housing units, because that is a serious problem. You know, in California, often, you know, you have these discussions about YIMBYs and NIMBYs, and, you know, all we need is more housing supply. You know, do we need more housing supply? Absolutely. Do we need to ensure that more of the housing supply is affordable? You bet. But do we also need to think carefully about how we utilize our existing housing? You know, yes, that is so important.
Yeah, and so to close out here in a second, just two questions tangentially related. One is, how much does the current crisis, particularly in California but across the country, how much is related to the buying up of housing stock by large financial institutions and private equity firms in the wake of the 08-09 housing crisis? I know that this is legion in my neighborhood of Highland Park, which is a very coveted neighborhood right before the crash, and then everything plummeted in value. Now it's very high. And a lot of the houses around me that before 2007, 2008 were owned by single families, they're now broken up into rental units. And then secondarily, the relationship of all this large institutional ownership of the housing stock, and then that the relationship of that to the barrier of achieving affordable housing in California, either through rent control, is there a greater appetite if those institutions are less prominent in the housing market for building new housing? And I suppose even the third question is, okay, we're getting blitzed by the money that's coming from this almost inexhaustible fund of money to try to defeat this campaign. And so, how best can that element of this campaign be communicated to the public, that we're up against big money, it's not in the interest of the people of California, and how can we get that message out to people and understand that we're operating in the best interest of the people of California?
There's a lot to unpack there. So let me try to take a couple different pieces of those questions and answer them. So first of all, let's just think about housing for a moment. I mean, the federal government subsidizes home ownership to a tremendous tune. I mean, we're talking billions upon billions upon billions of dollars every year, largely through mortgage interest tax deductions, where the U.S. government is more or less subsidizing the creation of safe and stable housing for the Americans that can afford to own a home, and for home ownership makes sense for them. Renters, on the other hand, are left high and dry. And it's important also to note that homeowners more or less have rent control already. Government created rent control, I should say. The 30-year mortgage does not exist in most countries around the world. That's something that the government, U.S. government, created out of whole cloth during the New Deal. And that more or less provides rent control for the majority of Americans who are indeed homeowners. On the renter side, we've essentially left them to fend for themselves. And what's happened, as we have increased market concentration in the rental market, you have landlords, often large-scale corporate landlords, have more and more what we call market power. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of discussions about market power and labor markets and how large employers drive down wages in certain areas, Walmarts and Amazons and the like. But only recently are we starting to realize that this market power taking place through the increased concentration in the rental market is also having perverse outcomes. In fact, the FTC recently filed suit for collusion against landlords, where they were engaging in price fixing to artificially boost rents and price gouge renters. And so, yes, we see this as a problem. But to be frank, the jury is still out when we think about how much of this problem, how much of this crisis can be attributed to the increase in concentration. I can't, I don't have that exact answer. It's hard to tease that out. One of the biggest problems, really, and this we don't talk about enough, is that the housing sector went into a depression following the 2008 financial crisis, and it never dug its way out.
Right.
We simply stopped building after 2008. And if you ask me the biggest problem with the housing market, that's really where I see some of the biggest problems stem from. But also, let's not fool ourselves. In 2006 or seven, rent was not affordable in most of California either. Yeah. So this is not a new problem, and this is not a problem with a single cause. Unfortunately, we've generated a housing market focused on extracting short-term profits for large corporations, and focused on building wealth for the middle upper class that can afford to be homeowners, while having renters be the primary individuals through which wealth is extracted from. Mm-hmm. And so the question we now need to ask ourselves is, how do we reorient housing from a nexus of profit to a nexus of stability, of home, of family, of safety?
Right.
And I think rent control takes a step in that direction.
It does. It does indeed. I mean, I think one of the things I suppose I'm getting at in the long question before is that this strikes me as a potential victory for Californians to really put a stake in the ground and say, we are going to reclaim what you just articulated, a California that is for the building of communities, the building of neighborhoods, the stability that can exist for individuals living where they can afford to live. And therefore, again, just like higher wages, have money in their pockets and be part of contributing to a positive economy in the areas that they live in. And right now, people are under such duress because of the cost of housing. I mean, it's very difficult right now. I mean, there, as obviously I have seen over the past, oh boy, really the past 4 years, many elections occur, and this is obviously a ballot proposition, so it's an election where the amount of money that's been flooded in against something that was popular, and you see the polls start to move against you, and it can feel very powerless. But right now, I think we have great mobilization around Yes on 33 and can, you know, produce a victory and a defeat to the powers that be that really not just skewing the market, but also are very invested in having the public being kept away from any influence over that. So,
You know, I mean, moneyed interest here wants to keep the spigot flowing, you know, from renters to their coffers, and there's no ends that they will not go to ensure that, you know, that the government not just, you know, keeps their hands off, but ensures that, you know, large corporate landlords continue to have just undue market power to squeeze renters for everything they're worth. And this is just a straightforward proposal to go after what has just really hamstrung renters and tenant advocates all over the state of California. So I think that, you know, it would be a wonderful thing to pass this ballot measure.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much, Mark Paul. Mark Paul, again, is a professor of public policy at Rutgers University and author of an exceptional article from 2023 on in the American Prospect on, again, the question of whether economists really are opposed to rent control, or are there studies, which is in fact the case, that are showing that that is mistaken, especially in contemporary America in the 21st century. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark Paul.
It's been great to be here with you.
Everybody, it's Alan here, and John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He is the author of just an amazing array of great books. I always like to recommend the co-authored books with Robert McChesney that he wrote over the decades. Fantastic analysis of American media, and really broadens out to American economy, American society. The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party is a recent book that John authored, and tells amazing history. And of course, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-authored with a senator from Vermont, I think we all know as well. So John Nichols is here today to talk to us about the 2024 elections, most particularly the presidential election, where we are right now, and what progressives can do to contribute to Democratic Party victories and the defeat of MAGA. And let's start off, though, in your home state. You, of course, are very well known for your reporting about Wisconsin, your writing about Wisconsin, among all the other works that you have done. How does it seem right now in this swing state? And what's the feel on the ground?
Well, Wisconsin's living up to its reputation as a swing state. I mean, that's just the bottom line reality. Most of the polling shows Harris to be either tied or a little bit ahead, which makes sense. This is a state where the Democratic Party has been doing well in recent cycles. Remember, Wisconsin voted for Democrats for president from 1988 until 2016. You know, so it voted for Dukakis, it voted for Kerry, it voted for Gore, as well as Obama and Clinton. So I think people got very used to the idea that Wisconsin was a Democratic state in presidential politics, much like Michigan and Pennsylvania. But in 16, Trump won the state. He won it by around 20,000 votes. It wasn't much, but that was a wake-up call. Since then, the Wisconsin Democratic Party, under the leadership of Ben Wickler, who has worked with PDA on a number of issues over the years, going back to his days with Move On in Washington, D.C., has really remade the party and made it into a much more activist grouping, one that is in the sort of the best spirit of grassroots progressive political activism. That's had a big impact in Wisconsin. It's made the state a place where Democrats have done well in a lot of recent cycles. This one's tough. I mean, you know, and it's tough for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, both parties know Wisconsin is close, so they poured money in. Alan, the ads are stacked up before the evening news. It's sometimes, you know, 20 ads during a half hour period. And they're very, very negative. The attack on Harris has been really rough from the, not just the Trump campaign, but all of these billionaire funded PACs. And so you've ended up with a close race. Harris has done something smart, and that has come a lot to Wisconsin. She's been a regular visitor to Wisconsin. I think she's up to like her sixth visit since becoming the nominee, right now, you know. So it's, and there's more coming next week. Obama's coming in next week. Walls is coming in again. So they're putting a lot of attention in. That's very different than the Clinton campaign, and it counts for a lot. You know, I think most of what they're doing is smart, but not all of it. And, you know, I'll be blunt with you. Harris has already done one appearance with Liz Cheney. She's going to do another one with Liz Cheney. Mm-hmm. That's trying to reach out to Republicans. And I think that's fine. If Republicans want to join a broad coalition to stop Trump, that's great. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that Harris and the Democrats should be doing a lot more outreach to not so much to the, you know, activist progressives, who I think are generally engaged, mm-hmm. but to disaffected progressives. And also to that great mass of people who don't usually vote, but who, when they are brought to the polls, vote a progressive line. This goes back, you know, really to the kind of core concept of PDA, Progressive mm-hmm. Democrats of America. Mm-hmm. Tim Carpenter believed this in his heart and soul, mm-hmm. that if you went out and you spoke to working class people who don't usually show up, you suddenly rally an army of progressive voters, right? Because these are people who want Medicare for all. They're people who want free education. They're people who want better services. And frankly, they're often people who are very concerned about war, mm-hmm. Because they're the ones who, you know, in a draft situation, which we haven't had for a long time, they're the first ones drafted. Mm-hmm. But they're also the ones who end up in the military because they are maybe very patriotic and they want to serve their country, but they also want some avenue that gives them a way to get an education and, you know, kind of gets out of a tough economic circumstance. And so when you add all these pieces together, that's where I think the energy should be. And my sense is that the Harris campaign is starting to recognize that. They put a tremendous amount of emphasis on outreach to, I guess the best word for it is, disenchanted Republicans, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. who would vote for Nikki Haley, stuff like mm-hmm. that. Tremendous outreach to them in September, early October. Now, finally, and I think it's very, very good, they're doing a lot more appearances at union halls. And this week in Michigan, Kamala Harris was at a UAW hall, I believe. I think she's mm-hmm. going to be more coming forward. That's really good. You know, I think if in the closing days they kind of keep on that track, keep on that emphasis, mm-hmm. Mobilizing students, mm-hmm. mobilizing working class people, mm-hmm. mobilizing people who are in unions, but also people who would aspire to be in unions, mm-hmm. I think they'll win Wisconsin. And I don't think they'll win by landslide, but I do think they can win with that strategy.
And of course, you do live in Madison. What do you sense is the sentiment on campus? Joe Biden did tremendously well in the 2020 general election with young voters. Is it similar this time, or you feel it's not where it needs to be and a push has to happen really in a big way in the final 2 weeks?
Oh, I think there's always a need for a push. And, right. and I would have said that to Biden in 2000, right? Mm-hmm, sure. I mean, Biden did do well on the campus. In fact, I will tell you, the way that I knew Biden was going to win in 2000, I can tell you exactly how I knew. It was like about 5 o'clock, maybe 6 o'clock on election day. And it was already, we're way north up here and we get cold too. And so it was dark and rainy and a little bit cold. And I was going by the former Gates of Heaven Synagogue, which is just on the edge of the student housing area near a park in downtown Madison. And there was a line around the corner, going up the street, people standing in the rain, or it was windy and cold. I don't know if it was quite raining, but it was really unpleasant. And as I stood and watched it, I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone, more and more people just kept coming, right? And I mean, that's the embodiment of a mobilization, of a grassroots turnout of what you're looking for. And I looked at that and I said, look, I know where these people are coming from. These are not folks who are going to come and vote for Donald Trump. This is, what is needed. And of course, that's needed again. That doesn't just happen. That is something that results from an intersection of actions, appearances by the candidate and by their surrogates, a real presence on campus, resources that go to mobilization, a defense of the right to vote, which is often threatened for students in Wisconsin and other states. But I do think that's in the cards. I see a lot of mobilization for Harris. Remember, Obama is coming on Tuesday to Madison. Mm-hmm. Tim Walz to do an appearance largely focused on early voting that will have, a lot of student overlay to it. Now, I think it's important for us, because we're talking to a PDA audience, especially, but I'd say this to anybody, to recognize that the issue of Gaza has been a factor. Mm-hmm. And in the primary in Wisconsin, in the student wards around UW, about a third of the votes were cast uncommitted. And so I think it's important to understand that the issue of Gaza remains real for a lot of students, as it does for a lot of other folks, right? Michigan, we talk a lot about Muslim American population. But if you look at the Michigan primary there, you'll notice that the same percentages in some of the predominantly Muslim American areas, some of the counties that had large Muslim American population, were similar to counties with large university population, right? So students become a real factor there. And, look, if I could write the script, I would have Harris make a much stronger, much clearer break with Joe Biden and the administration on Gaza. And she's said some things that are very good, but then she's, it's always been this sort of gray area. And I do think that's something of a factor. But at the end of the day, and this is, being around the campus, watching the energy, I think at the end of the day, you're going to have a very large mobilization, much of that mobilization driven by the issues of abortion rights and student debt. Those are real. Students, like everybody else, are diverse. They have a lot of different issues that influence them. And with the right mobilization, I suspect that the campus at UW will produce a vote pretty similar to what you saw for Biden. That's good for the overall mix in Wisconsin.
Two final questions about Wisconsin. As I told you before we spoke, in Arizona, PDA is doing something rather unique, calling actual Green Party members in sort of a deep canvassing way of dialoguing with them and asking them, trying to convince them to vote for Vice President Harris. Of course, Arizona, another swing state, is difficult work. Okay, so how much has Jill Stein been present there, and how much traction might she have? But second question, so you can just roll into it. I suppose this is almost newsworthy. There's a lot of consternation on behalf of Republicans and speculation or informed speculation in the media that the Trump ground game is a failure.
Yeah.
You have any evidence of that? So Jill Stein's presence and then Trump's ground game in Wisconsin.
A little quick download on both of those.
Yeah.
I haven't seen as much Jill Stein presence as I had in the past. And certainly dramatically less than what you saw, some years ago when Nader was running on the green line. It is less. And remember, I always tell people, with third parties, if you want to run as a third party candidate, you got a right to do that in America. And in Wisconsin, you get your signatures, you get on the ballot, you got a right to be there. It's the job of the major parties, if they're afraid of losing votes to a third party, to do the outreach, right? To communicate about why it's important. And that's what you're doing. Okay. And so that's important. I think we always respect the role that third parties play, because they put pressure on the major parties to do the right thing. The dynamics of any particular election merit conversation, that deeper conversation. I respect you for having that conversation. I think in Wisconsin, if I'm reading it right, and I could be, it's always a tough call, I think there will be some folks who will vote for Jill Stein out of respect for her, and they want to vote for her, right? And they're not going to change. There are some folks that will vote for Cornel West out of respect for him, and they're not going to change. There's probably maybe a larger portion are going to vote for the Libertarians. And they usually get a good vote in Wisconsin. So there you go. But there are some swing voters, and talking to them, reaching out, I think is consequential, because one thing to understand about Wisconsin, we have close elections. Of the last six presidential elections, four were decided by under 25,000 votes. That's closest in the country by far. And so it isn't just about talking to somebody who might vote for a third party. It's about talking to a whole range of people who either might vote for somebody else or might not vote. So I think all of that, the kind of deep canvas stuff, really matters. And doing it, you know, getting down to that level of a real conversation, and respecting the person you're talking to, respecting their concerns, respecting also the power of information. The second part you asked about, tell me exactly what it was.
The Trump, the failure of their canvass.
You know, it's a little different here than in some places, because the Republican Party here is run by some pretty sophisticated people. You know, Brian Schimming, who runs the GOP in Wisconsin, has been at it for decades. And he's no fool. And so I think there's been a little bit more of a sophisticated mobilization here than in some other states. But I will also tell you, there's this kind of, you know, it's clear that a portion of the Republican mobilization has been kind of contracted out, farmed out.
Apparently, Musk is trying to jump in on that.
Yeah, and to the Koch brothers with AFP, and some of these are Koch brothers aligned groups and stuff like that. And I can tell you, that's just not as effective. That's effective for the Democrats or the Republicans.
Right.
You know, one of the things is you bring in a lot of people who are not really engaged in the place where they're working. That is less effective. What's effective is if your neighbors are knocking your door, right? If people from at least your county, your community, that's very effective. And that brings us back to one of the subtleties of Wisconsin. And I think a few other states, Jane Kleb is doing some great work in Nebraska as an example. And that is, when you mobilize the county parties, when you get them to build up and to be real, I have an acquaintance down in Walworth County, Wisconsin, very Republican county, named Ellen Holly. She's been working for like, you know, better part of a decade longer to build the Walworth County Democratic Party. I was talking to her the other day. They have almost 500 active volunteers in a rural county. They go knock on doors. Let me tell you, that's much more powerful than somebody who got hired by Elon Musk to drive into some place. So I do think the mobilization in Wisconsin does tend to favor the Democrats. Although I will tell you that, again, because this has been such a battleground state for so long, both parties are better here than in a lot of other places.
Well, Wickler, of course, I do think he's tremendous. He spoke at Progressive Central in Chicago. Had a great, great speech. And of course, also a tip of the hat to Nate Timm in the rural outreach program.
And can I just give you, I mean, because you referenced that. I know we don't have a lot of time, so I don't want to go too far off track here. But I will tell you, I just was with Senator Sanders up in Baraboo, Wisconsin, which is a town of 12,000 people, for an event last Saturday. It was in a high school or junior high gymnasium. You couldn't move. People were sitting on the floor. It was a huge turnout in a, you know, small city surrounded by rural county area. And as I drove up there, that's right through the old Nate Timm territory, is a good reference, and many of his friends and allies. And there, farm field after farm field had a Harris Wall sign.
Oh, that's great.
It was kind of amazing. And these were handmade signs. These are not, you know, they're not the sophisticated ones from the campaign. These are, I think, are much more powerful because they're real. You know, they're clearly painted by people, you know, who live out there in the county. And anyway, so, yeah, that sort of stuff, which is very tied, by the way, to PDA, very closely tied to PDA.
Yeah,
that's real. And it's I physically saw it just last weekend.
Well, actually, of course, you know, the Nation magazine, D.D. Guttenplan, is very enthusiastic about the Rural New Deal proposal that we put out with Anthony Flaccovento, and Anthony's been working with D.D., so that's something going forward. So in the home stretch, and now as we don't have that much time together, the other day we spoke about trade issues. You have some ideas that you think you'd love to see Harris put forward. So maybe present a couple of those, or that one in particular. But also, look, it's important that citizens communicate with each other and try to persuade, even if it's just posting on social media, get something out into the ether. I do feel, even in the negative critique of Trump, and I know that that can win a lot of votes for the Democrats and they should be pursuing it, I feel like they right now aren't emphasizing enough the positive reflection back of that, which Harris is a great, should be a great messenger for, which is the building of an inclusive American society, one in which we all move forward, not with this division, divisiveness, and castigation of the failures of the society whenever the Democrats are in charge in the cities and so on and so forth, but actually paint a very positive picture, but one that's fully inclusive, the establishment of a multiracial democracy. For instance, on university campuses, I think that could really motivate votes for Kamala Harris. And if that, if we don't hear that being said enough, I think it would be great for PDAers to get that kind of message out. You know,
Look, PDA has always been an optimistic group. Mm-hmm. Back to, I mean, you have to be, frankly, because PDA has backed some pretty uphill causes over the years.
Yeah, well,
You know, healthcare not warfare, windmills not weapons. Mm-hmm. These are messages I agree with, mm-hmm. and they're also messages that I think a lot of Americans agree with. But our media system, and right. frankly, our political system isn't set up to celebrate that.
Right.
And so as a result, it's a hard fight, and one that people, you have to kind of jump over a lot of media, jump over a lot of the political elites to deliver right. that message. When you do, it resonates. And yes, a positive vision for a progressive future mm-hmm. is something that has tremendous potential in Wisconsin and nationally. Mm-hmm. I travel all over this country. I've been in most of the states that are in play in this election cycle. And I can tell you, people are longing for it. This mm-hmm. is one of the things, and you say Harris is a good messenger for it. She is. And one of the reasons she's a good messenger for it is because she seems to be enjoying being out there, right? Mm-hmm. And as she says sometimes, look, people are tired. They're sick of the, you know, just constant negativity of our politics, which I think is rooted deeply in Donald Trump and mm-hmm. rooted deeply in a politics that goes back to the Reagan era. And at the heart of it is a belief that you kind of make people hate politics, you know, hate the whole mm-hmm. thing mm-hmm. so that the right can then have its space, right? It's if everything's awful, then the right wing messaging somehow can resonate. Whereas if there is a positive alternative, it's less likely that the right wing messaging resonates. So it's, I think one way to say it is sort of almost an effort to pull the whole process down. Mm-hmm. In a much more depressing place. Harris, at her best, has sought to kind of raise it up. Mm-hmm. I think Tim Walz has done some of that as well. But here's what I'll tell you about having covered politics for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's important. The most effective messaging is a blend of critique, mm-hmm. opponent, as well as positive vision. Mm-hmm. And I think that voters, they can handle that, especially if it's done in a sophisticated way. And so you want to give people information that they need mm-hmm. and then give them a way out of it. And you see, that's where the problem comes in so often is you just get the critique. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's really bad. Be afraid of that person. But then it's like, okay, I agree with you. I'm afraid. But what do I get? You know, I mean, if I join you and vote with you, if it is out of fear, if it is out of anger, whatever, where do we go? You know, how do we get out of this so we're not constantly doing this every 2 years, every 4 years? And one of the ways that I think that the Harris campaign and frankly, Democrats who don't always get this right, and I've written books about how they often get it wrong. One of the ways to talk about it in this cycle is an interesting one because there's so much outreach to working class voters, multiracial, multi-ethnic working class voters in these battleground states. In many of the northern tier, blue wall states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, these are either manufacturing workers, former manufacturing workers, or people who aspire to be manufacturing workers, right? Mm-hmm. And there ought to be a strong message for them. And the message is actually, I mean, it's kind of just handed to them. Donald Trump, when he was president of the United States, reorganized NAFTA, right? Which was mm-hmm. very unpopular. One of the greatest successes of organized labor in the last 25, 30 years has been to help working class people to understand that trade deals usually screw them over, right? Mm-hmm. And that they should be skeptical. And NAFTA is in a lot of American working class communities, it's a swear word, right? Mm-hmm. And people mm-hmm. don't like NAFTA. Well, here's the interesting thing. Trump rearranged NAFTA, right? He reorganized it. And by the account of the UAW and folks who really care about these issues that follow him closely, he screwed it up as badly or worse, right? That many of the things are now more of a mess on trade policy than they were before mm-hmm. because of Trump's NAFTA. Mm-hmm. So for the Democrats, that's an easy issue. That's one, even in these last 2 weeks for progressives, especially people who understand economic issues, to talk about Trump's NAFTA, to mm-hmm. use that term as the UAW has, as Sean Fain, I interviewed him the other day, uses that term all the time. They now have T-shirts and messaging about that. And here's the interesting twist on it. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris was a member of the Senate when they were doing that reorganization of NAFTA. A handful of senators saw through all the smoke and whistles, all the buzz, all the talk about how they were going to make it all make trade better, and voted no. One of the people that voted no was Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Another one was Kamala Harris. So mm-hmm. she's actually got the issue, and she's been on the right side of it, not as a candidate, not even, you know, not rhetorically, but she actually cast the vote, the necessary vote. And I can tell you, that's powerful stuff. Take that to the union halls in these last few weeks in Kohler, Wisconsin, and Flint, Michigan, and York, Pennsylvania, and so many other places. And I think it has real resonance. I think it's also something for a group like PDA, which really has always been great at understanding mm-hmm. deep economics and the impact of bad trade policies on multiracial, multiethnic communities across this country. PDA got that long before other Democrats did. Now, in this critical juncture, I can think of a few groups that are probably better positioned, along with the UAW, mm-hmm. to deliver that message as part of their deep canvassing, as part of their outreach. So, yeah, it's, I mean, when we talk about, and you and I have talked about this a lot, I think this is a big deal.
Yeah, no, and John's latest article in The Nation is Donald Trump just insulted every auto worker in Michigan, and I believe this is the reason that you were in dialogue with Sean Fain. So Sean Fain would be an incredible messenger in the blue wall states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Does he have plans to be touring those states in the coming weeks? Because it would be brilliant if that can happen.
Well, there aren't many weeks left, my friend. Yeah, thing to be very conscious of.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
That clock is ticking super fast.
Don't vote on November 6th, people. Vote by November 5th, okay?
Yeah. But one thing we've woken up to is the reality that, you know, what seemed like a long campaign has now become, now we're counting minutes, right?
Right.
You do have to go to the right places. Right. And that election on November 5th is going to be an absolute critical juncture. Many people are already voting now.
Right.
So where you put your energy, where you put your resources matter. And that circles around to saying, yes, you're absolutely right. Sean Fain touring Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I'd like to see him in Ohio. And people don't always look at Ohio as a battleground state. The fact is, Harris is at 46 there in some polling, you know, not doing all that badly. But more importantly, Sherrod Brown's running for re-election there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Eastern Iowa, again, not always seen as a battleground state, but a couple of congressional districts that are very competitive. Historically, John Deere plant in, I think, the Dubuque area. I mean, these are places where UAW can and is already mobilizing. They're doing mm-hmm. a lot of work. Fain, I think, is going to be working himself very, very hard over the next few weeks. He's also been out to Nebraska to campaign for Dan Osborne.
Right.
Yeah, for the Senate out there. And that's a big deal, too. Independent, labor, progressive. Getting beyond just the boundaries of the Democratic Party, running as an independent. And so I think that matters. But one thing I would say, and I don't know if this will happen, I think it would be wise. Kamala Harris has appeared quite often, or several times now, or plans to. She's already done one appearance, she's going to do another one. With Liz Cheney. I'm not sure Liz Cheney is going to really excite a lot of the disaffected voters, mm-hmm. including disaffected progressives. I think an appearance with Kamala Harris appearing with Sean Fain mm-hmm. would do a lot more of that.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Now, I'm not one to tell you it's fine. If Republicans want to join this broad coalition that against Trump, that's fine. But I think a lot more energy should be put into appearing with people like Sean Fain. And delivering that message that, you know, there really is a difference here. And Fain does it brilliantly. I think that Harris, in her appearance in Michigan the other day, showed that she's, you know, quite up on this as well. Mm-hmm. And what I would argue is Trump has given the pro-labor progressive forces the tools that they need, right? Mm-hmm. His policies have been failed. His record is troublesome. Recently, he was in an interview where he suggested that people, assembly line workers in auto plants in the U.S. simply take things out of a box and put them together and actually compared that to something a child could do.
Mm.
stunningly insulting statement, which UAW has responded to in a very, very negative way. I mean, as they should. And so it seems like there's almost a sort of a perfect aligning of message and moment here. And if the Democrats seize on it, if progressives seize on it, people understand that sort of labor left tradition. Mm-hmm. I do think there's space to really make some things happen out here in these last 2 weeks. In fact, I would dare say that this close, difficult, contested election, not just for the presidency, but for the Senate and the House, could well tip ultimately on some of these fundamental issues. Abortion rights will still be central.
Mm-hmm, right.
No question of that.
Right.
There are other issues that are very, very central, the inflation and all that. But if you're looking for sort of a final tipping point issue that might bring some people over
right.
that you might not have otherwise had, mm-hmm. my sense is that some of these trade issues and some of these economic issues have real resonance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and of course, it would be so spectacular for Sean Fain to be recognized as a voice that helps lead to victory in these states, because that then sets the table for the power and influence of really one of the best and most powerful developing forces in American society right now, which is his leadership of the UAW and the labor movement rising in general. And just to close, though, with where we are in all the whirlwind, I mean, Kamala Harris is poised to be a president that we as progressives believe we can be heard as we present our ideas. Now, we're not going to believe that she's Bernie Sanders, but we think that we're going to be able to have our ideas, have a hearing. I think Pramila Jayapal, the head of the Progressive Caucus, is confident about that as well. So we'll go forward, and we'll go forward positively. Donald Trump, it is still really astonishing that he is close to winning an election when January 6th happened. Just for your closing remarks, because I remember you did great work at the end of the second George W. Bush administration. Right. About the necessity of not allowing all of his illegalities to go forward and not to be called out. Donald Trump is a serious threat to this constitutional republic. Does that not have much traction in Wisconsin? And do you feel that it's, I mean, with swing voters, is this something that should be leaned into? And how much do you think that should be central to the talking points that, again, we as PDA put out and put forward in the next 2 weeks?
Well, you know, look, I've been at this long enough to remember when PDA was one of the few allies in the effort to impeach Bush and Cheney for their absolutely destructive policies and during a presidency, a co-presidency, really, between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney,
right.
That gave us not just massive tax cuts for the rich, but a illegal and immoral war in Iraq.
Right.
And all the destruction and, frankly, all the horrors that have extended from that. Mm-hmm. So I do think that accountability matters. Mm-hmm. And I think people get it. I do think people understand it. I think a mistake was made when Bush and Cheney weren't impeached. Mm-hmm. And I know now everybody's all excited that Cheney is endorsed. Right. Mm-hmm. But I've still got my impeach Cheney first pin. Oh,
sure.
And I think that accountability in politics matters. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump has, look, I mean, it's hard to even imagine. It's almost incomprehensible when we right. talk about it, that here's a guy 91 times indicted, 34 times convicted, all of these legal challenges that seem to have kind of faded a little bit of late, but are still all very real, twice impeached in both cases on a bipartisan basis, and in the second case, with the brilliant leadership of Jamie Raskin in the House of Representatives, getting a large number of Republican senators to vote for conviction, right? The highest number in history.
Right. Sure.
And so, you know, that is all there. And the fact that Donald Trump now is running on messaging that pretty much every expert on authoritarianism, right. every expert on fascism tells right. you this has too familiar a ring. So the argument for making that history, that record, a part of the discourse, mm-hmm. yeah, of course that's relevant, and it matters. The only counsel I would give mm-hmm. is that America elects a president. It mm-hmm. doesn't defeat
right.
a challenger to that president.
Right.
And so at the end of the day,
right.
your message has to be a combination, as I said mm-hmm. before, an intersection of the record, reasons to be unsettled, the reasons to be fearful of a opposition candidate, but also the vision of why you vote for someone going forward. And I think that's the thing to understand about Kamala Harris. I've interviewed her a number of times and seen her in a number of settings. One thing I can tell you is she is deeply knowledgeable of labor. People always say that Joe Biden is the most pro-labor president in history. I'm still going to give Roosevelt some marks in that regard.
Sure, sure.
but I will tell you that the person who headed the labor task force within the Biden administration was Kamala Harris.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
At those union conventions, the person who was doing that outreach to the apprentice programs and everything, that was Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows labor. She knows working class issues really well. Mm-hmm. The point person of the administration on abortion rights and reproductive freedom, Kamala Harris. She knows these issues. She understands them really, really well. And frankly, the daughter of immigrants from India and Jamaica, who grew up in a home with a single mom and who really made her way on her own. Differently. This is a unique figure running for president of the United States. You may disagree with her on some issues. You may, you know, there may be aspects you don't like, whatever. But the one thing you cannot deny is that you have someone who grew up in a culture of politics that I think a lot of us would understand.
Right. Sure.
And who was active in the anti-apartheid movement, who was, you know, has been active in all sorts of progressive things, who once told me that she didn't eat a grape throughout her entire childhood because her family respected the grape boycott of the United Farm Workers, one of the first unions to endorse her, by the way. So when you put all these pieces together, I think that yes, there's always room to criticize Trump, but it's also important to look for that positive vision. Doesn't mean you have to agree with somebody all the way, but it does mean that it's valuable to recognize who this person is, what they've done, and frankly, how by any measure, Kamala Harris would be a fundamentally different, and I think a far more humane, far more spoiled Democratic president, and far more open to the left president than Donald Trump.
And John Nichols, thank you for all that you're doing and for your leadership and for your brilliant journalism. And thank you for joining us today.
It's an honor to be with you.
I'm back here, and I'm joined by Alan Minsky. He is no stranger to our airwaves. He spent many years as our program director, and he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And I think you can guess it, but we're here to ask you for your support. And it's a really important message that we bring you. KPFK, and part of the Pacifica Foundation, is not funded by, as you know, corporations or anything else. We are entirely a listener-sponsored radio station, not a listener-supported radio station. We don't ask for your support along with a bunch of underwriting, but we just ask for your sponsorship. And this is the time that we need you to do it. So we're going to ask you to call in at 818-985-5735 and support this radio station and specifically this program, Beneath the Surface. And I'm going to let Alan talk to you for just a second. But I want to say that, you know, I've been on the air for a very long time. And of late, I've been sort of specializing almost by default on topics that I feel we can go into some depth on. One of them, of course, is in my own area of, let's call it expertise, and that's the former Soviet Union and Russia. Putin is more repressive than we could have imagined, and so I've been covering a lot of that, and also labor, which I continue to cover. And these are kinds of topics that, you know, are not necessarily covered even on our own radio station in any kind of depth. So I have nothing but fun bringing them to you. And we'd like to hear your support for it. Alan?
I really want people to think about Susie's show and the kind of understanding that she provides for, obviously, she just talked about some European politics. She has exceptional coverage, of course, of Latin America and really of the whole globe. And what she provides is a capacity to look beneath the surface, right? Famous name of the show, and to see the sort of broader historical trends that are playing out in the specific manner in which they're playing out in all of these countries, and sheds light on what our reality is living in the 21st century with much greater depth than you get in almost any analysis on any show I know of anywhere else in American media. And I mean that. You're quite privileged in a way to be able to hear beneath the surface over the airwaves